to me, that's just another way of expressing going for refuge. That to me is what going for refuge is about, is that willingness to come back.
We've been having a discussion recently about lifestyle and how lifestyle affects practice, and the debate, well, just recent discussions with friends, this issue of whether we have responsibility in some way to change our lifestyles to accommodate our practice, or whether we work with our lifestyle to accommodate our practice. And my sense of it at the moment is that we work wholeheartedly with our life as we find it.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because most of us, especially if we take on responsibilities, if we have, you know, children or whatever, we don't necessarily have that ability, that freedom to actually pick and choose what we actually might do for a living. And the Dharma, you know, the characteristic of the Dharma, this is something else that people, I think, get wrong. The Dharma is in everything. It's in every moment. It's in everything that you do, equally. It's not more in one thing and less in another. It doesn't come in sort of degrees. It is whole and perfect in every moment of life, in every moment of being, in every situation that you're in. So the Dharma is always there waiting to be discovered, and whatever you happen to be doing. Now, it so happens that it can be skillful to create more wholesome conditions and less emotional conditions. The Dharma is more likely to arise in those circumstances. But the Dharma is still, it doesn't only come through those situations. The Dharma is in everything. And if you're very skillful, you can discover the Dharma, you can see the Dharma in anything that you do. So because you're not in one of these sort of perfect, sort of right livelihood, you know, situations, which most of us in the world aren't, doesn't diminish your ability to practice or your ability to discover the Dharma. It's down to you. It's not the circumstance. It's not the situation. It's you and your engagement. And I know it can be that often people, you can't really practice because you're married and you've got children. You know, you're not, you know, if you're single and you're living in a community and you're right livelihood, okay, in some ways you can say that's maybe more desirable if you've got a choice. But the fact that you're married and you've got kids and you've got commitments and your life is virtually planned out for the next 20 years is a golden, is a wonderful opportunity for you to practice the Dharma, because you are very much engaged there, much more so than the person in a community, generally speaking, in living your life for other people. You can't just pack up and go off and do whatever you want, as single people can do. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but see the virtue in things that very often people look upon as not ideal in this practice. That's nonsense. It's you. It's your attitude. It's your commitment. It's not the worldly circumstances. It's you. And whatever your job may be, Whatever it may be. I mean, for myself, when I came to practice the Dharma, I took up gardening at exactly the same time as it happens, and I don't know whether by chance or what, to actually create myself quite a good quiet environment. And I've always actually been in that situation, really, all my practice life, where I've had lots of time on my own and space. That's my good fortune, if you like. But, you know, in another situation, I could have been caught up in other things. I can't then turn around and say, well, I can't practice the Dharma, or I can't. It's nonsense. it's entirely your what you want to do, your input. Don't blame others and blame situations. It's, you have to take responsibility for that, whatever it may be. And that's the great wonder of the Dharma, as I say, is that the Dharma is in everything. The Dharma does not pick and choose. It is us who picks and chooses. We decide, you know, we put things in compartments and create this world of values and stuff. The Dharma is way beyond all of that. It's not interested in any of that nonsense. And that's why the Dharma is for everybody. any human being on this planet, irrespective of their culture or their upbringing or the privileges or non-privileges, anyone can practice this because the Dharma is ever present, and that makes it unique and makes it truly wonderful. Could you give an example? Well, every
just
time.
Thinking about my own life, you know.
So well, you do pick. We all pick and choose, don't we? We all give values and priorities and goals and things to avoid and things we want. Mm. That's picking and choosing, isn't it? Which I'm not saying. Obviously, we have to take control of our lives and guide our lives. Of course, you know, we don't put our hand in the oven. I mean, you can call that picking and choosing. I choose not to put my hand in the oven because, you know, that's a stupid thing to do. But if you make the Dharma the priority in your life, if your life is lived out of the practice of Dharma, you will naturally refine or as much as you can. You will see certainly the things that you are in control of, that you can actually change or declutch from. As time goes by, you'll do that bit by bit. You don't necessarily have to do it consciously. Little by little, things change. When I, you know, think of myself now to 20 years ago, the things that I engage in, it just happens on its own somehow. You just don't, you know, you don't wake up one morning and sort of scream out, "I'm not going to do that anymore." It just seems, there seems to be sort of an evolutionary thing that takes place very, very often. And, you know, in that light, it is very often a process of experimentation. You experiment with things. Well, is that a good thing to do? Is that a wholesome? Is that a conducive thing to do? And try it, you know. Try it. Who knows? And if it doesn't work out, then you sort of let it go, don't you? Or if it does work out, then fine. But learn to play with things and not take ourselves seriously as well. I must be a pure, perfect person. I mustn't do anything wrong. I mean, that's, you know. It's not something I've ever engaged in. Things, as I say, if you are really committed to this practice, things will take care of themselves bit by bit.
I think you mentioned a couple of times there the change, transformation coming about on its own. I mean, I noticed in myself. Any of the changes that have come about that have stayed, I've only noticed them after the fact.
That's right, in hindsight.
It's something happens and I realise, actually, I do what I usually do.
Absolutely.
And you go,
right, that's it.
The stuff does work then.
That's right.
It's that kind of, and this is called constant experience of realising, in retrospect, that transformation has taken place.
That's right.
And I think, too, as well, is that you're not. You can't actually guide it. You put an effort into it. You try to create conditions and circumstances that you hope will bring about this transformation. And as you say, when you fall down, you pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and get back on the horse again. And it's just that constant, it's just commitment, that effort. And eventually you just realize you've actually done it, in a way, without having done it, which has come about.
That's right.
And I think too, from my own experience, certainly with success like that,
you want to put it that way, is it has been...
I'd rather not, actually, but I know what you mean.
I know what you mean. to realise you've actually, you know, that transformation has
something's changed, yeah.
That you've successfully worked with something that's been a difficulty. Success in that sense. That it has been my experience that it has been my ability to accept it, first of all, whatever that is that I wanted to change, that I really, the first thing I had to do, after doing all sorts of other rubbish, was eventually get around to accepting that whatever it is actually part of me. It is a fundamental, in a way, part of who I am, what I am. And just that acceptance, first of all, really getting through that you have to accept it before you can really successfully begin to let go. And to, again, I think to accept that it's just going to keep coming back until you do, that it is transformed. And you see it again, you go, here we go again. And I think the other thing is advice I got from my first retreats, which was developing a sense of humour in a way with ourselves.
Not taking yourself seriously.
Falling down.
Yeah.
And instead of, to develop out of the habit of beating yourself with a stick, was to, I think for me, what developed was a kind of a wry sense of humour. Okay, I'm kind of going like, okay, you've done it again, you know, okay, that's fine, let's just move on from here. Yeah. Not in that kind of sense, but just kind of developing that kind of sense of accepting that this is just going to keep on happening.
Yeah.
But you've got to keep working at it.
Yeah.
Not in a fatalistic sense, but in a sense of, okay. No. And then going, well, actually, you didn't do it quite as bad this time as you thought that, or you didn't get as far into it, or you caught it quicker. Or to begin to look at the positive aspects of the experience, even if it was a negative, want of a better word, experience. And that kind of, in a way, it's a firm but gentle way of dealing with whatever it is, habit, whatever it is. So you're still fearing that you're, you know, it's actually not how you ought to be, but you're gentle in saying, accepting that, well, it is how you actually are at the minute.
So you're making friends with it, aren't you?
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing. I would say, I mean, what you say there's, you know, right on the button, actually. Except that you said that, first of all, you have to accept it before it changes, before it then starts to change. But it's actually the accepting that's the changing is taking place when you actually, there's nothing else to do other than accept it. And that's the magic of it, if you like. It's the accepting, which is like not doing anything, is it? It's just simply allowing it to be and staying with it, which is, you know, if it was a conflict, you're just accepting that side of yourself maybe that you thought was unwholesome. So you, by accepting it, you're making friends with it. This is the dharmic making friends. The worldly making friends is to go and say, oh, hello, shake hands, and how are you today? And, you know, engage with it in some way. But the dharmic way is to just accept it the way it is and not to judge it, not to engage with it in any way, not to give it any value, but just to simply allow it to be. And in that accepting, that's where the change takes place. It doesn't take place after that. That's it. That's actually the changing process. And it doesn't actually go beyond that. And you just see the simplicity of it. Really. I mean, this is not rocket science, you know. We do make this thing so complicated. You know, we do, oh my God, I can't do this. How do you do this practice? You know, you express it so easily. It's just about accepting yourself and making friends with yourself. And in that, it will change of itself. What it takes, an extra ingredient now, though I'm sure you had it, is the more insightful you become of that, the more you, when you accept it and you stay with it, you become very, very intimate with it. And the more intimate you are with it, the same as anything else, the closer you are to it, the more you can see into it. And it's in that looking deeper and deeper. And this is the great value of insight practices, which I suspect most of us here don't have, But the value of an insight practice is that it's not anything different to just doing normal practice, is that it has that cutting ability. You can cut that much deeper. But actually what it's doing is no different than just simply accepting and getting to make friends with yourself and learning to live with yourself and make friends with yourself.
Yeah, I think a word for it is recognition of it as much as anything,
yeah.
More than a greeting. It's more of just you recognise that it's there and what it is. I think for me part of the process too was to come up against something and go, and then instead of trying to work with it or engage with it or contain it, whatever word you want to use with it, as it presents itself at its surface as what it seems to be, was to start then to look into it and to identify what are the underlying conditions that are giving rise to it, because it may seem like this big thing which is hard to deal with, but what I begin to find is that you begin to look further under as to what are all the various conditions that are giving rise to this particular big thing, then you realise there's all these other conditions which are actually more subtle but also more amenable to change than to think of this one big object, whatever it is, to sort of objectify it as this problem, rather to look at the conditions to try and see under it through meditation quite often, just
yes.
To try and see what's percolating down there, and these are the things that are more
you look into and you get to yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. You just have to avoid the danger of getting intellectual about it.
Oh, yeah.
That's the dividing line with this, is that you start saying, oh, that's so-and-so, and you remember something you read or something somebody said, and then you create a list, and it's this, this, and this, and then there's this sort of, you know, you engage intellectually with it, conceptualise it, and that's not the Dharma. That's a pointer, that's an upaya to take you to that, but then you have to let all that lot go and actually live it, actually become it, become one with it, and see that, oh, I am that list, as it were, I am that concept. And the more intimate you get, so it becomes a living thing that you actually carry it around with you. When you get to that level, that's when things begin to turn over. Because that's real.
So how does one do this? Look, because it seems to me that if I begin to engage with it, I'm actually analysing. You know, so okay, I've got the emotion, I'm feeling it, I can contain it. So the next step seems to be looking into it. But it seems to me that it's easy to kind of begin analysing the emotion. And I'm just wondering how. What's the nature of this looking?
Well, then yes, we fall into that habit, into that thing that we've nurtured since we were children of analyzing, of intellectualizing with things. And this is what we have to learn. It's got its place in the scheme of things because it takes you to a point, but then you have to let that go and then step beyond that intellectualization.
Into what though?
Well, into just the bare experience. And it's like meditation. I don't know what your meditation's like, but you know that when you, whether you're supposed to muse insight in your meditation or not, I don't know. But, you know, you can start off on a very superficial level, and the more quieter and the more concentrated and one-pointed your mind becomes, that sort of crude thinking then gets into more, you would describe it more of a musing on a more subtle, deeper level. And then actually, when your concentration gets even sharper, you even go beyond that, and it's more of a bare seeing. You just seem to look at something without actually engaging in words. There's a knowing.
You actually feel it.
Yeah. Well, you become it with awareness and with aliveness. The deeper you can go there, the more you can nurture that, the better, because that's when you'll be much closer to the Dharma. The more conceptual, the more dualistic it is, this is where the self begins to engage, and or at least those are the conditions for the self doing. I understand this, and I you know get into all of that sort of intellectualization with it, and then you'll miss it. But it's the staying, you see, because it's an ongoing process, if you like, an ongoing practice, is that by learning to stay with yourself on a daily basis, when somebody takes the milk and has got no milk in the morning when you get up, you know, don't dismiss that as something irrelevant and trivial. The more that you can stay with that experience, the experience that you get from that simple, mundane thing that happens to all of us all of the time, the more that you can get intimate and stay with all of that reaction, that's nurturing that ability to go beyond the intellect, to go beyond all this thing called Buddhism, and actually, so that it becomes a, you know, pinch yourself, there's no thoughts there, where's the thought there? That's just an impact, that's before thinking arises. That's where you're heading, that's what you want to try and get to, as it were. And that means a real letting go of yourself, a real just emerging, becoming one with that. And the more intimate that you get with that, because that's really alive, I can assure you, you are absolutely alive. When you really get into that, when you really do become that what you are looking at, that's where the Dharma is. It is very subtle. It is. I agree with you, and this is why so many people in Buddhism get locked into the whole intellectual process. They think, "Oh, I'm developing insight," and the dividing line between developing understanding intellectually and developing understanding from a dharmic level. You know, there's no space. There's not a gap that you jump across, and it's so obvious. It's about degrees, and it's about subtleness, and it's about familiarity. And familiarity comes about through commitment, coming back. You get more and more familiar with it. And in the end, you actually do see what's Dharma and what isn't Dharma.
I guess the problem I see for myself is that it seems that the crucible for this to happen is, I guess, the lower abdomen, whatever you mentioned, the lower part of your body. At least for me, my awareness is mostly around my chest. And even if I try and drop it into the lower part of my body, it seems like there's nothing really there to hang on to. It's like I don't have that sort of awareness, it seems.
No self-awareness.
Well, I have self-awareness, but it's mostly either between my ears or...
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. You don't have self-awareness
down there.
You have self, i.e. ego awareness
ego.
Up here.
You've got something...
But what's down here is beyond the ego.
Yeah.
And
well, how does one get that?
Well, it's about learning to come back and nurturing. It's a nurture over and over. We're trapped in delusion, and we have to learn to go beyond that delusion. And this is what Dharma practice is about. And this is the engaging wholeheartedly in the familiarization. Little by little, you don't just do this, you know, because I sit here and talk about it and you say, oh yeah, oh I see, that's what you do, and then you just go and do it. Can't work like that. You yourself have to work at it, and that comes through commitment. And then little by little you'll become familiar with it more and more and more and more, and in the end you want to be there, you want to live there, because you discover this is where the Dharma is, this is where the wonder of it all is, where you leave yourself behind and all this nonsense that we're engaged in, and you really come home, you really get into the basis of your being, beyond all of that, and that's where the Dharma is, and that's where change takes place. But it's something that you have to keep coming back to over and over and over and over and over.
So is there any merit in, say, trying to breathe deeply into the lower abdomen, trying to cultivate that?
Slightly, yes. Well, if you want to, the next time we talk, that's actually a good place to start. But we're losing the schedule, so we can come. We've got to clear up as well. So. Before we move on, ever onwards and ever deeper, I hope very much that what we've been talking about all day is not confusing. Confusing in the sense that, you know, I mean, everyone has a practice. What, how they perceive their practice and basic tenets and basic signposts and the way forward with it within their practice. Does anyone feel that what we've been talking about today in any way sort of clashes, or is it somehow completely different? Have I just got out of a spaceship, or or can it be? I mean, the idea, which I hope is working, is that you can take what's been said today to broaden and deepen what you've actually got, what you're actually doing. I mean, it isn't something new in a sense. It's just filling out, if you like, what we're all doing. I don't believe that even if we had people from other traditions here, it would really impinge on whatever practice they're doing. Because I think these are sort of, the way it seems to me anyway, that these are very much the basic principles of Dharma practice and change. And they actually don't belong to any tradition. Whatever culture, whatever tradition we take on, these are very much to do with the clothing that we drape around the Dharma. Underneath the clothing is the living Dharma, but we shape it for our culture and for our particular tradition. But the basic fundamentals, I believe, are universal. So I hope what's been said so far is not in any way sort of contradictory or confusing. Is everyone okay, sort of? Good. So I think we can just carry on with what we were saying earlier, or pick up where we left off and spend most of... This is our last session today of discussion, so maybe we could exhaust this aspect of things in preparation for tomorrow, which is still basically the same, but maybe we'll introduce a few new sort of perspectives just to clarify. Because this is a very, what we've been talking today has been very, really very broad, I would say. Maybe tomorrow we can pick up on some aspects of containment, or the difficulty of containment, and highlight those and bring them out. But you were saying earlier,
we could go back to this.
We broke off at lunch.
That if, well, I mentioned how my awareness can be between my ears or around my chest. But I think you said that if you don't have that awareness in the lower part of your body, in the abdomen, then one doesn't have self-awareness really.
We have to be a bit careful about the word self.
Yeah.
I don't mean self in the sense of ego self. Mm. That living experience. The sense of self, the sense of ego, which I think maybe we could touch on a bit more tomorrow, is very much that part of us that exploits life and our experience of life, and then turns it into a very self-centered, self-motivated exercise that then causes the basic trouble that we're all experiencing. but if you find that your practice does tend to be pretty much in your head, which I think is what you're saying, with a little bit of body involved, it's perfectly natural and perfectly normal when we come to this practice that of course we have to orientate ourselves, we have to take on the concepts of Buddhism and the Dharma, and especially in this movement there's such a terrific emphasis on study, and the basic tenets of Dharma study is really about orientating ourselves into the Dharma. It's a turning away of the habitual experience of living our lives in our heads and actually turning that ship around, as it were, and facing it actually into the Dharma. And that's, I think, really is the essence of what study's about. It's not an end in itself, it's a means to an end. Because we can't think our way to Nirvana. Although I think, well, I've heard of one or two people who seem to think you can do that, but I have my doubts somehow. That would be a very easy way out, wouldn't it? And I think that's the basic. I think that's the basic, the real function of the conceptual side of Buddhism, is that it's actually a skillful means. It is not the end in itself. It's a means to an end. It's an upaya that orientates, helps us to focus. But it carries a very great danger, and this is why we always have to be so careful about conceptual Buddhism, is that we take it very, very easily. We take it to be the real thing. And when we work a few things out with our minds, as we do, we read concepts, we haven't got a clue what they mean. And so we look into them and we read a few things and we talk a bit with people, and then slowly we get to some grasp of, for example, the Four Noble Truths, which is unknown in our culture. And because we get some sort of intellectual grasp of what that's all about, we think that's it. We think, you know, oh, I'm wise. I'm practicing correctly. I'm developing wisdom. And to get locked into that whole intellectual conceptual aspect of things, and it's incredibly powerful. It's incredibly alluring, and it's so convincing that most of us can't let that go. We can't. We say, yeah. Oh, yes, you're right. But then we just go straight back off again, back into the old habitual ways. And it is a very, very powerful attachment. Ultimately, it's a Mara. Even if it is pointing to great wisdom, it's still ultimately a Mara that you have to be very careful of. Once you allow yourself to get sucked in by that and convince yourself that this is it, you will miss the Dharma, you're missing the point, and you end up living your life, living your practice in your head, and this is what happens to so many people. And I believe, just going right back to the beginning when we first started, I think that the Dharma is in the totality of ourselves. It's Nama-rupa, it's in the totality. It isn't in just one aspect. I don't deny the intellectual side. We are human beings and we are intelligent and we do think for ourselves, and that's very necessary, even in the practice of Dharma. But it is a part of the whole. And it actually, in the scheme of things, actually ultimately doesn't have a great large percentage in the Dharmic scheme of things. It's very much more an intuitive, contemplative, nurturing practice. And as I was trying to point to earlier, that when you really do become alive and aware to yourself and really do start this nurturing process, you will find that it goes on a deeper and deeper level. And at least if even if it's only intellectual, to really try to nurture that coming back into your body while you're doing this practice. This again is not, you can't do this by an act of will, which is really what I'm trying to say to your question, that you know you could maybe understand what I say and accept what you say, but then you can't just do it by an act of will, because we've got so habitually caught in our heads, caught in our intellect, caught in this thing that seems to know all the answers, that we can't just let it go by an act of will. It becomes something very deeply ingrained, and it has a very, very strong self-identity. You see, that's ultimately the problem with it. It becomes my practice and my understanding and my wisdom. And that attachment to that, it's a very strong sense of self, and that becomes a very powerful attachment. And we can't let that go by an act of will. But through this nurturing of containment, which we, as I say, hopefully we discovered, it's much, much more in our form. And the more we look into it, the more we get to know it, we see that it's lower down. And the more that we can, as it were, change the habits of a lifetime. So it is they are habits of a lifetime. Even coming to the Dharma actually has not shifted those habits, because we still continue to live in our head the same as we've always done before even we came to the Dharma. And to learn to get familiar with that more and more and more. And this all takes place through this basic practice of containment, where we actually learn to live from our body, live out of our body, not to live out of our heads. And the more that we can actually come back into our body, the more that we can be aware of our body in all situations, in all the four postures, in all the experiences, our daily experiences, whether they're mundane or whether they're very important to us, the more that we can actually see that we're living out of our body, the more we can begin to turn that ship around, so to speak, and actually stop doing this practice in our heads and trying to work it all out with a pencil, and actually come back into come into the body and go into the place where the Dharma really is. Because the Dharma is not in the head. Much as our intellect and our sense of self and ego would like to convince us this is where the Dharma is, actually it isn't there at all. And slowly this hopefully begins to dawn on us. And the more we stay with that, and the more we look into that, the more we begin to understand ourselves, and truly begin to understand ourselves. And the more that should be, hopefully it should be inspirational, that actually maybe I should turn away from this trying to work it all out with a pencil all the time, trying to work it out with thought, and actually come and actually live life wholly, wholeheartedly, just experience life with very bright awareness. And in that cultivation, you'll become aware of yourself more and more, and that will have nothing to do with your intellect. That will be a part of you that's beyond your intellect. And in that nurturing, slowly you will come back in, and you will come back down. And certainly, when you sit down on your and to do your meditation, you will find yourself gravitating to that. You will find it easier in your meditation, obviously, because we're creating an environment for ourselves, a conducive environment. You will see more and more that this is where it's at. This is where the Dharma is. And the more you look, you'll see everything there. You'll see the Dharma. You'll see where samsara is. You'll see where the whole of life is actually emanating from, where it's actually coming from. And you become much more one with that, and you begin to understand it more deeply. And you'll see the world being created, and you'll see that which creates the world. And then in that very same place, you'll see how the world can become uncreated, and that which is beyond the world. And that truly is the inner journey. We're always talking about spiritual practice as being an inner journey. That, the inner journey doesn't take place in the head. The inner journey takes place within, deep within us, inside of yourself. And all the questions and all the problems and everything will be resolved just by learning to get closer, learning to open up, learning to make friends, learning to commune with all of that. Things will become clearer. And in that clarity, things will change. But, as I keep saying, we have to nurture that. We can't do it by an act of will. You could all agree with me now. Hopefully, well, maybe you do, hopefully you do. You could all agree with me, say, yeah, great. Then put it into practice and see what it's like. You see how difficult it is. Because we've got ourselves into such a pickle. We've decided to live in our heads. We've decided that we can live life in our heads. We can work life out in our heads. And we can work everything out in our heads. And patently, we can't, can we? We wouldn't be here today. Clearly there's something wrong with that, isn't there? Somehow it's not working. Why isn't it working? It's because we're going in the wrong direction. We're looking in the wrong direction. And the whole of Dharma practice, the theory and the practice, is about focusing. Turning the whole... The Buddha likened this Dharma practice to being carried along by a stream, by a river, by the current of a river. And then one day you decide to stop and turn around and go against the current. And that's how we liken Dharma training, Dharma practice. You can't turn around and go against the current just by an act of will. You've actually got to engage in it, and you've got to engage continually with it in order to go against the current, against the stream. You can't just turn around and float back upstream. You have to actually engage yourself. And that is the essence of the practice, and it is a commitment, because the moment you relax, the current just sweeps you back downstream again, doesn't it? So it's a consistent, steady commitment effort to go against all of that, to work with that, which is not to be carried away by it, not to be carried downstream by it. And it has to be learned, as I keep saying. This is not an act of will. It has to be learned. But it can be learned if you want to. If you want to learn it, you will. And you'll do it. But you'll see the forces. You'll see the forces that are saying to you, no, you're not going to do this. Sorry. You can think your way out. You can think your way to nirvana. That's a much better and much easier way. We'll carry on with that way, the way we've been doing all these years. But when you actually turn around and start to work with all of that that thinks that it can find its way out by thinking, then you'll see what you're dealing with. And that is in your body. And you learn to work with that. You see it and you learn to work with it as deeply as you possibly can go. Until in time, you will actually become much more integrated. You actually know that, apparently, so I've been told, there are actually people in this business who don't even know they got a body. So I've been told. And then people engage in all sorts of therapies just to get in touch with their body. Oh, I've got a body. They're so locked up in their minds that before they even can really come to the Dharma, they've actually got to discover they've actually got a body as well. I mean, I find that quite difficult to relate to, but at the same time I can understand that and why is that? It's because we live in our heads. We spent all of our lives just trying to work everything out with our minds. And hopefully one day we wake up to the fact that actually that doesn't work. So... maybe that's where we're all at, and the sort of thing that you're expressing is that there is that just that habitual thing of trying to work it all out. Well, starting from tomorrow, or today, or this moment, learn to stay with that life force that's flowing out. Learn to stay with it and learn to contain it, and learn to get closer and closer and commune with it and become really alive and become really aware. And inside of all of that, you'll discover the truth. And that has nothing to do with this fellow, nothing to do with your ego, beyond all of that.
I'm just curious to know what you mean by what your experience of mindfulness is saying it's in your chest. What does mindfulness mean for you?
No, it's not even mindfulness, it's just my sense of awareness. Maybe it's a sense of gravity or something, I don't know. But
my impression is that although what you say, but you can't just, we do quickly rise up into our heads very easily. It seems like there are things you can do in terms of just bringing awareness lower in your body, and you were saying about like breathing down here.
That is a good way of actually becoming aware that A, you have a body, and that actually you have there's a lower part of your body as well. It's like it's in sections, as it were. And this could come back to meditation. I don't know how people are taught how to meditate in a physical sense. No, I'm not talking about the theme, the subject, but actually, in terms of posture and in terms of actually how we go about physically meditating, hopefully people are taught or they learn or they discover that when we breathe, when we're sitting, we actually breathe through our stomach much more than our chest. I mean, us people in the West, we're taught to breathe with our chest. People in the East are taught to breathe with their babies breathe through their stomach. Their stomach just rises and falls. That's the natural way of things. But in our culture, we're taught to breathe through our chest. Put your chest up, put your shoulders back, sort of stiff upper lip, soldiery type thing. And consequently, that many of us actually breathe. When we breathe, we fill our lungs up from the top down by sticking our chest out like this. The lungs actually fill from the top down, and consequently, our lungs don't properly fill. Whereas if we learn to breathe through our stomach, if our lungs draw the air in because our diaphragm, our stomach, is actually going out, the vessel, the lungs, actually fill from the bottom up, which is the correct way of doing it. So if you watch a child, a baby, this is the natural way of doing things. I mean, apart from any other consideration, is actually the healthy way to breathe and fills the body with oxygen. But apart from that, what that does, again relating it to meditation, is it does help to ground you. It keeps you down here. You've got your legs and your backside on the ground, and your weight, your form, should be down on the ground, that to give it that solidity. If the weight is up here, your awareness is up here, it becomes top heavy. It's unstable. So by even doing that, even just breathing properly, never mind what your meditational subject is, actually you become aware. Your awareness comes down here, and it's a part of mindfulness of breathing, or one of the ways of focusing on mindfulness of breathing is to be aware of your abdomen rising and falling. I don't think it's done in the movement, but that's one of the traditional ways of actually putting your attention down here while you breathe, and you can feel it. It's quite a crude sort of reflection. It's not a refined one. It's like the crudest is the counting. The second is to put your attention down here, and that's just by doing that is actually hopefully making you aware that you have a body and that you're actually breathing down there, and to bring your attention down there. And not only meditating, but you can actually do it when you're walking around, when your mind is sort of fairly peaceful and you're not caught up with lots of very important things to think about. You can actually just bring your attention back to your breathing, just the rising and falling of your stomach. That's all helpful. That's all helping you to bring yourself back. You're aware that you have a body, for one thing, which seems to be quite an achievement. But secondly, you know, you're coming much down. You're coming much more into the base of your form, which is where the Dharma is. This is where the Dharma is.
If I start thinking, just recollect your awareness, Don, what happens is, this is what I become aware of.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how it is for me, Jerry. So if I say, okay, just collect yourself, Don, what I become aware of is it's here.
Right.
As opposed to my toe, my feet, or
right.
It's just this.
Well, that's a habit that you've got into.
Yeah.
Okay, now you can start to nurture a fresh habit. Put your attention on your breathing.
Yeah.
This actually shouldn't impinge whatsoever on whatever one of the mindfulness of breathing, or if you're doing your one of the aspects of metta.
Mm.
It should not impinge and alter it in any way. It should actually nurture it and help it. So don't think that by doing this, you know, you're not doing what you've been taught to do, you know, in terms of those practices. But it's very much helping you become aware. It may seem very simple, but actually, like I keep saying, we forget this. We rise up like a cork. We bring it down and oh yeah, don't doubt. And then the cork rises up. We're in our heads again. We've lost it. So you have to catch it and come back down again. Come back into that form until it becomes a habit. Until it comes to the point where, when you discover that you're not aware of this, this is wrong, and then you come back into your body rather than the other way around. It's habit making. It's habit. It's all it is. It's reconditioning, if you like. But it's a skillful reconditioning. It's an upaya. It's a means to an end. But it is a conditioning. A relearning.
How does this impact on the experience of metta? How you express or how you feel in that there's a tendency to
not in the conceptual way, you mean?
Yes.
What you mean the method, the four or five stages.
You could do that entirely in your head.
Yeah, well, but you can also bring it down into your body and do it. So it shouldn't actually impinge at all.
Mm.
It shouldn't it shouldn't affect it at all.
There's two things there. First of all, actually, Kamala Shura mentions all of that in his book, particularly about breathing down here. When dealing, particularly when he's talking about dealing with sinking and drifting in access in particular, when you're getting too much into your head, he talks about breathing, actually noticing your abdomen coming in and out.
Good.
To draw your attention back down.
That's right.
And actually, when I discovered that, it's quite powerful.
It is powerful stuff.
And even to use... some lower part of your body as your focus for your breath, imagining your breath coming in and out through, say, your navel or something like that, to actually watch the breath coming in and out through there. The other thing too is Jerry says, I remember Ravandi saying something, gosh, in one of the retreats in the last few months, and he was talking about the metta bhavana, that if you become distracted, to actually bring your awareness back to your entire body.
Probably, yeah, yourself.
Yeah, to get that back, to really ground yourself back in your body, because that's where you're trying to get the metta from.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
But when you found yourself sort of wandered off, as you come back, before you come back to the actual metta itself, come back to the body first.
Mm.
Get yourself back, you know, really feel that, a quick scan, feel yourself right back in and then back into the breath.
That you're grounded, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to see some of it teaching. Yeah, I start them off for 1 week lying on their back and breathing in through the lower abdomen, breathing out through the heart. But what
like
I've learned
this.
Over the years is that...
Like him.
What I've learned over the years is that it's remarkable how many people can make progress doing partial breathing, doing bits of breathing. For example, somebody being stuck, I shouldn't say stuck, I suppose that's what I think about being. Somebody being actually just encapsulated in the, I used to do a critique of living just in this area here when doing mindfulness of breathing, and yet for some people in their early days, or for other people much later on at a later stage, that degree of sheer concentration can actually be really, really dead useful. Another thing I found myself leaving aside, let's just say years ago, that it's that thing of, there is an understanding in some of the traditional texts that stage, are sequentially more difficult, four stages of counting, breathing in the sati practice. But I keep coming across folk for whom that's not the case. You know, okay, stage four is the easiest, or stage two is the easiest, or stage three. So I'm a wee bit more sort of soft on it now. It's a case of, like, fundamentally, I agree with you, and yet I just do want to put a wee flag up for this thing of just how far some folk can get some of the time doing some of this partial.
Yeah, really, what you're talking about, where you're coming from, is that development of meditation
mm-hmm.
itself and skillful ways of developing mindfulness and going on from that, which is fine, but this is a sort of a nurturing of the spirit of actually going on. I mean, I'm actually looking sort of beyond that, as it were, into an insightful way of beginning to see yourself. The soul. Well, remember, this is on tape. Yeah, because I tend to look at it in a sort of a holistic way, in terms of complete practice, as opposed to just bit. I'm not actually picking out specific meditational techniques and doing that. Something I tend not to talk about. I just try to take it as a holistic, and of course the meditation is a part of the whole. But it's really a nurturing of that strange thing called the spirit. It's the spirit of the practice. I don't quite know how you define the spirit of the practice. It's not an intellectual thing. It's your engagement with it. It's your feeling. Your love. Your will to want to do it, and to nurture it deeper and deeper. And there's all sorts of factors involved that I could sort of all put together and say, this is the spirit to nurture, this is the spirit of the Dharma, this will take you deeper into the Dharma, that spirit, rather than sort of break it up and find a sort of a conceptual path. And, you know, cause to me the spirit is beyond concepts. It's a living commitment. And I think that's very, very important to nurture. And this is all part of that getting away from the head, that you can work it all out. Cut the Dharma up into compartments and, oh, let's work that one out. Oh, right, I understand. Now, well, let's go to this compartment and work this compartment out. Whereas the spirit is much more of an embracing of all of that and just sort of nurturing it on a deeper level and seeing it as much more of a holistic thing rather than a fragmented thing. And I think that's really where I'm coming from with all of this. I mean, I appreciate, and I know there's lots, I mean, just the whole phenomenon of meditation you could talk about for days, and all sorts of levels and all sorts of perfectly valid ways of, you know, expressing the whole exercise. But for me, I see it much more, as I say, as a developing of the spirit, of the totality, and of not seeing one posture as being more important than another, and to see them all come into one, and an equanimity that comes from that spirit, is that you don't pick and choose, you don't say, oh, this is a good time to practice, or this is good practice and that's bad practice, and getting to that judgmental thing and that cutting up and fragmenting thing, but much more of a spirit of just embracing the whole lot and just learning to practice in all conditions, all emotions, all postures, whether you're sitting or whether you're in this here now, sitting down, talking and listening, or having lunch. See it as the same. The Dharma as I said earlier, the Dharma is in everything. And you know the Fourth Noble Truth? You know, we like to talk about the Eightfold Path, and you know, the path that we split up into eight convenient steps and then talk. But I don't... That's an upaya. That's a way of actually describing or expressing how we actually do this practice, because we have to learn it. But actually, the essence of the Fourth Noble Truth, the reality of the Fourth Noble Truth, is actually equanimity. When we are truly economists, when we are truly have that equanimity in all postures, in all situations, we find the middle way. And when we truly alight on the middle way, that middle way will take us through all postures, ultimately. Not just we practice the middle way when we're on the cushion, or when we're in some situation that we decide that, you know, we want to engage in. But when that middle way is like a thread that runs through our entire lives, when that thread is actually nurtured and it's consistent through all postures and all situations, this is the peak of practice. You can't do any more. This is it. This is the ultimate. And when you abide in that state and you stay in that state, nurture that state and stay in that state, then the Dharma will open up. Then that's when you would enter the stream. And that's the perfection of the Fourth Noble Truth. So for me, I see that rather than just, as it were, put my eggs in one basket, focus on one particular aspect of this, I'd much rather stand back and see it as a totality. Because ultimately, if there is that desire, or I don't know what you can call it, that wish, that hope, that ultimately we do enter the stream, that equanimity, that middle way, there's no compromise on this. That middle way has to be ever present in all situations. And when it's truly ever present, when it's truly there, this is when the Dharma will truly reveal itself through what we call stream entry. And that's what we're working towards. So if we focus that on that in the beginning, whatever we do is always going to be taking us down to that final step, final stage. And I think to embrace all of those factors, it's really a nurturing of the spirit towards everything, and an embracing of all of life, and a not discriminating and a not picking and choosing. And the more we go down that road, the more we get out of our discriminating mind, and the more we actually come into our body, and the deeper that we go into ourselves, we will find that equanimity is actually waiting there for us. That middle way is there waiting for us. We don't make the middle way. We don't create it. We discover it.
To the sense I get of bringing yourself to your body is it's almost like, you know, geographical point in space. So the reality seems to be, or for me anyway, it seems like it's for most people, you know, that geographically, you know, your spirit, you could almost say, is up here. So that being the case, then, or we have our awareness of it up here. Is it that being the case, then it's a wise move to keep orientating it down here? I'm just trying to put this in my own words to see whether I'm not
mm-hmm.
off the wrong track.
What, do you think your spirit's in your head?
No, I think that's my bad use of words.
You're into
psychic space, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm locating, I didn't mean it like that. I'm saying two things. One is like I get the sense, or what I feel of when things are going right, if I'm listening to what you're saying, is you actually locate your awareness, or keep bringing your awareness back to this area in space.
Yes.
Yeah. And awareness in this sense means your whole what you would regard as the spirit of your practice.
Yeah.
So that's what you're doing, and because we're up here so much, in a sense, that's why it's the most important thing to do, because if we're not doing that, then all the other stuff is on the surface,
yeah,
or it's in the wrong place.
Right.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a coming home. It's coming into the into the soul, into the heart, if you like.
Stunting.
Whoops.
You see
how easily led I am.
It feels like that's the way.
Yeah, actually, you know, a part of this path of discovery and a part of the wonder of it all, you know, we're convinced that we actually live in our heads, and we are in our heads, and I exist in my head, but actually, when you really, really go into that, you really begin to start to doubt that, actually. Do I actually really live in this brain, in this head? Is this the real me? Is this really me? It's a very interesting journey, discovery. And you may begin to even doubt that you live in your head, ultimately. It's spooky. It's spooky to that doesn't like the idea of that. But actually, there's something beyond that, actually, which is far more wonderful, far more expansive and wonderful. That actually, when you actually begin to discover that, it's not spooky at all. Actually, it can have its fear elements with it. But when you discover that, I think you begin to discover, possibly for the first time in your life, that you spent your entire life in jail, and for the first time you actually get a taste of freedom. Somehow the doors swung open, and you at least you get to look outside, even if you don't get to step outside. And then you really begin to see how incredibly ensnared and trapped we are, and how we're just bound by something that's so deceiving, that's so clever, but actually is pathetic, actually. Without wishing to sort of develop sort of negativity towards yourself, but that thing that thinks it's so clever and that's so alive and knows everything, and the thing that we attach to so very, very powerfully, actually, in the scheme of things, is pathetic. So to make that discovery can be really quite inspiring, quite liberating, quite inspiring, quite uplifting, energizing. And this is what I think, one of the things that you discover the more that, and you really do begin to doubt this whole assumption, I am here, I am living up here, and this is my body down here. And that duality, that's like the initial duality, me and my body, that's where the whole dualistic world starts, and then you project it out. I am here, Donald's over there, this space, I am here, I am this person here, I am this separate being from the world. This is where loneliness comes from. This is where fear comes from, that very, very, very basic a notion that we create for ourselves, a separation. And that separation, the very first separation that we create, is me and my body. And so this whole practice, this whole process, is like going right the way back to the beginning, coming right back before that first thought arises. And when we get back there, then we are free. And that, to me, is the journey. And it's, you know, well, maybe we can talk about engagement with that tomorrow. Mm-hmm.
You talk about kind of reconnecting with the body and getting out of your head. Body work, such as, you know, healing the body, connecting with the body, homeopathy, osteopathy, all of these kind of things. For me, when I get involved with those things, it would seem that there's quite a lot of emotion stored in the body. And when I say that I get a treatment of osteopathy, you can pretty much guarantee 2 days afterwards there will be a rush of emotion through my...
What, negative?
Yeah, through my being, normally anger. And, you know, that's very, very kind of, can be very strong and overpowering. And I was just wondering what the kind of merit in that, in the, you know, being, I do feel much more, say, connected with my body if I continue to get treatments and... So, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, that's, it's really much, it's not, Dharma practice isn't about releasing energy. It's about transforming it.
Mm.
And it's basically transforming it from ignorance into wisdom, if you like, or transforming back into its original state before it got twisted and warped. It isn't about sort of releasing it out into the environment or just unblocking a plug hole or something just to get rid of it. But what it does show you, it just shows you what sort of a state we're actually in when you actually begin to sort of move in that direction, just that energy and the state that it does bung up and block up the body and creates. And this, I'm quite convinced, is where 75-85% of our physical ailments come from. It's because of this imbalance with this natural energy flow that we should have. But because of our ignorance and non-understanding, it's like water flowing through clean pipes, and it all flows all nice and freely and naturally, and it's wonderful. And then we start to put blockages in there, and then it gets builds up of energies and all sorts of things start to happen. And I think that's what our mind does to our body, because I don't think the mind and the body are two things. You see, when your mind is out of balance, your body will be out of balance, which is a very, very clear indication that you can't separate mind and body. And when you are much more at peace with yourself and much more liberated from this sense of self, your body will actually be a lot healthier. Of course, the body's nature is that it is unstable, and eventually things go wrong. That's the way it is. We can't avoid that. And no doubt there are lots of genetic factors as well that maybe we can't avoid. But I think a lot of our ailments that we experience in our life are caused by our mental states. And what you're doing there, you're releasing some of that energy that's actually... would be very destructive physically, but through these ways you're actually getting rid of it. But that's not dharmic. I mean, that's much more of a, you know, sort of a medical treatment, if you like, although it's not conventional medicine. But I mean, is it actually sort of dealing with the material side of ourselves, releasing that energy? But you know, the difference there, I mean, within Dharmic practice, it isn't about getting rid of that, it's about transforming it. And when it's transformed, those, what you're doing, if you want to put it in these terms, you're transforming the blockages. And once the blockages are transformed and you no longer have any blockages, then you will be, not only will you be free of lots of